Please join me in Revelation chapter 11, verse number 19. I feel the need to comment a little bit more expansively on this passage that we had right at the tail end of last time together. It is a passage that I believe answers the question definitively, where is the Ark of the Covenant? Now, if you are kind of a fan of fantasy and science fiction like I am, you may have enjoyed Indiana Jones and the Ark, the search for the Ark of the Covenant. But it's all fantasy. It's all silliness and foolishness based on some bad information that is out there historically. There has been this longstanding idea that King Solomon built two Arks of the Covenant. One of them he built as a replacement for the original, because he gave the original to the mother of his love child from Sheba, and that this Ark was taken back to that illicit son's home country, Ethiopia, which is kind of a mixture of bad information by itself, because Ethiopia and Sheba are not the same place. But that's the Ark of the Covenant that people have claimed has been in Ethiopia all these years. It's not. The other claim comes from a Jewish legend that Jeremiah the prophet secreted the Ark of the Covenant away in a place underneath the Temple Mount. Some stories have it being taken to the other side of the Jordan and put close to where Moses the prophet was buried. But that won't matter, because this is the truth. All you have to do is go to the authentic history in the Old Testament of Jeremiah the prophet, and you know that he was hated by the religious authorities of the temple, and he was under confinement all through the final months of the siege, and even past the time that the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. So he had no opportunity or ability to have secreted the Ark of the Covenant away. All we know for sure from the Old Testament story is that the last time the Ark is officially mentioned is a couple of decades before the temple and Jerusalem were destroyed in 587 BC. That's the last time we hear about it, until this verse. And so I believe this verse tells us exactly where the Ark of the Covenant is. It is currently housed in the heavenly temple or throne room of God Almighty. And I believe, furthermore, this is my speculation and it's worth what you're paying me for it, I think that it will be brought back as the millennial and eternal throne of Jesus Christ. Because one of the things that is also misrepresented about the Ark of the Covenant a lot is that the Ark of the Covenant is not a highly decorated box for storing things in. It's actually a portable throne, a stylized portable throne on which the Old Testament saints were supposed to imagine God himself being seated there in first the tabernacle and then later into the temple. And his voice emanated from mouth height between the cherubim, between the four-faced, four-winged angels that were decorating this throne. And so you should think of the carrying staves, the carrying sticks, the gold-plated carrying sticks, going along the short sides of the ark, and that the ark is like a sedan chair. And the cherubim, instead of having their wings, you know, covering both sides, they only cover up over the top and along the back. And then the front is open because the king, of course, is going to be seated upon this throne. So that's what my belief is that the Ark of the Covenant was designed to be and will serve as the throne of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, Yehoshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah. And I base all of that on the very firm information right here. Revelation 11, 19, then God's temple in heaven, very specific, was opened, and the Ark of His covenant was seen within His temple. So, problem solved. Ark of the Covenant, currently in heaven, soon coming to planet Earth with Jesus Christ, who will seat upon it. Now, the last thing that we saw in last session, at the end of the seventh trumpet, the seventh wrath event, is that there were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and heavy hail. We'll see that in a little bit more detail in the seventh wrath event associated with the seven bowls. And it will show things happening in association with the second coming of Jesus in the sky. The book now shifts. Remember, there are no chapter or verse divisions in the event in the original letter. But it is clear that we move from one vision to another vision at this point. The vision we've been looking at since actually chapter 4, because we have the throne room of God vision in chapter 4 and 5. The vision we've been looking at for several sessions now is the vision of the scroll of God's final wrath and the seven trumpets that are sounded as His final wrath when that scroll is opened by Jesus Christ. We are now going to go back and retell that same period, the final 3.5 years, with a little bit more detail and a little bit different angle on it. Because this time we're going to look at it as a longer, bigger story. When we were looking at it in the last vision, it was a quick and let's get this done sort of vision. John cries because he's afraid that if no one can open the scroll, God's wrath can't fall and we can't move forward. So the last vision was a boom, 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 boom. This one, more drawn out. Chapter 12, verse 1. A great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. Now, there's been lately a bunch of attempts to say that this has got some sort of astronomical tie-in, and as is always the case, I will look at that with an open mind to begin with. But if I see pretty quickly that it doesn't have any real good evidence for it, I will abandon it very rapidly and critique it strongly. And I'm going to tell you that that's the case here. This idea that this is an astronomical sign for one particular day and that you can predict a future event based on this verse is not accurate. The sign Virgo has an affinity with the sun and the moon and a certain group of stars on a pretty regular basis. So it is not a unique event. I'm going to use the word, it's silly to claim that you can pin it down to one particular date as being described here. Instead, let's look in Scripture itself, because remember I teach all the time that the Bible is its own best interpreter, its own best commentary. Do you remember a young man by the name of Joseph? And do you remember how God gave him dreams? And these dreams got him in trouble with his 11 brothers, actually his 10 older brothers, not his baby brother, the 11th amongst them. One of those dreams that he told was this: I dreamed that the sun and the moon and 11 stars bowed down to me. And his brothers got mad at him first. And then his father said, are you trying to say that I and your mother and your brothers are going to bow down to you? And so all the elements of this dream are right there, or this vision are right there in Joseph's dream. And Joseph's dream came to pass in his time period, in his life. I think we can use that as a tie-in to Israel. I think that the woman here should be identified as the ethnic Israeli line because of the tie-in with the 12 stars being the 12 tribes of Israel, according to Joseph's dream. Now, we have to fine-tune it a little bit more as we go, and that is that it is not exclusively the Israeli line, because there was a prophecy made about a woman all the way back in Genesis, long before the Israel story got started with the 12 boys. And that was a threat that was issued by God against Satan, where God said that I'm going to put enmity, Satan, between your seed and her seed, the seed of the woman. And her seed is going to crush your head even as you strike his heel. And we pretty much universally agree that that is the first prophecy about the death of Jesus for sin, that he would pay the penalty for sin with death and thankfully rise again. And it would look like he kind of lost, but in fact, he won. So the seed of woman story got started there in the book of Genesis, and the promise was made generation after generation. Somewhere along the line, the seed of woman is going to win against the seed of the serpent, or as we will refer to him, the dragon here in a little bit. But as we get to the time of Joseph and his brothers, that seed of woman is now funneled into a specific genetic line known as the Israelis. And so now through that line, the promise is made. Some woman in this line will give birth to the avenger. And then it's fine-tuned a little bit more because David is told that one of his seed is going to be the one that will sit upon the throne forever. And so now we know that it is a member not just simply of the human race, not just simply of the ethnic Israelis, not just simply of Judah, but of the line of David, that the victor is going to come. And so we know that over a long time, Israel was hoping and waiting for this child to be born until finally we come to the ultimate member of that line, that chain, Mary of Nazareth. And I know that there are some of my Catholic friends that you believe that this definitely is Mary here. I would take dispute with that because she's only part of the whole story. And so this is all about the long wait from Genesis chapter 3 until Matthew, Mark, Luke, John bring Jesus into the world. Verse 2. She was pregnant. She was crying out in birth pains, the agony of giving birth. And then, John reports, another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. Now, we will develop more of the understanding and decoding of the 10 horns and the 7 diadems, all of that. We'll do that later because we've got passages from Daniel plus a passage later here in the book of Revelation that will help us with that. But you should know that the ancient mythology of the Middle East already had a 7-headed dragon that they were concerned about. It was the dragon of the sea, the dragon Yam, or the dragon that was in the Abusus, in the abyss, which is also an ancient name for the ocean and for the sea, that this dragon caused great trouble for mankind and needed to be taken down by a hero. So that imagery is now playing out in front of John in his vision state. Remember, he's a seer, so he sees things, then he describes them, and then, hopefully, explains them. Verse number 4, his, or the dragon's tail, swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. Now, we cannot definitively prove it, but I do believe and teach as a precept that Satan is being described here in verse 4 in his original rebellion. That as the dragon, bad guy in this story, he managed to corrupt or deceive or convince a good third of the angels of God's creative efforts to join in his rebellion against the Creator. These fallen angels they're not a majority, they are a minority, but they are a significant minority. And so these are the troublemakers throughout the history since Genesis number 3. They're the ones in Ephesians chapter 6 that Paul says our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but it's against principalities and powers, against these world forces of darkness in the heavenly regions. So they're in the supernatural realm, and they hate us and cause nothing but trouble for us. But the prediction is going to come up later that all of these fallen angels are going to be kicked down into our dimension, out of their own and into our own at the beginning of the 3.5-year period. But back to the text, verse 4. The dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. So yes, you can think of Mary here in verse number 4, the woman Mary is going to give birth to her son, Jesus, and Satan was certainly looking out for an opportunity to kill baby Jesus when he arrived. We have the example of Herod the Great. Once he did have a line on where Jesus might be, tried to kill him. I think that was clearly satanic in its origin. But it's not simply Mary, because Mary represents the end of a long line of Israeli women, of women from Eve right down through Bathsheba. That'd be the mother of not Solomon specifically, but of Nathan, who becomes the bloodline that Mary comes from. So that whole long line of all those ladies are going to give birth to Jesus. So verse 5 happens with the nativity. She gave birth to a male child. That's Yehoshua, that's Jesus, one who is to rule all the nations, not just Israelis, all the ethnic groups, with a rod of iron. I think that's a reference to our millennial period that we'll see later. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. So we suddenly jump through the whole story of Jesus there, because it's the ascension suddenly. So we've jumped from the nativity right past his growing up and his doing miracles and his gospel stories and the death and the resurrection. We've gone straight to the ascension. And what happened at the ascension? The apostles were told by the angels, this same Jesus that you saw taken up from you will be coming back in like manner. So this is the real fast forward event here in verse number 5 and verses 5 and 6, because not only did we fast forward through all of Jesus' ministry straight to his ascension, as we begin in verse 6, we jump forward to the beginning of the day of the Lord, which is 3.5 years before Jesus comes back. Verse 6, the woman, so this is why it's not Mary. This is why it's not just simply, one individual lady that was living in the first coming period, because it has to span. This lady has to span from the first coming to the second coming. And so I believe, and this is what I'm going to teach you, I believe this lady should be thought of as ethnic Israel, but specifically ethnic Israel who believes in the gospel of Jesus. So messianic Israel. Verse 6, the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared for her by God in which she is to be nourished or taken care of, fed for 1,260 days. Now, where did we see that number recently? You're right. That's how long the ministry of the two witnesses is. Now, the 3.5 year period is 1,270 days. So this is short by 10 days, just like the ministry of the two witnesses is short by 10 days. And I think there's a reason for that. I believe this lady, which represents, I think, ethnic Israelis of a messianic bent, I think these folks are going to be in the direct presence of the two witnesses. I think the place in the wilderness that was prepared by God is going to be Jerusalem. It's going to be where these two witnesses do their ministry and where they eventually die. Now, I'll develop that a little bit more as we push forward in the story, but I want you to kind of give it a chew, think about it a little bit. I know that there are those out there that say that it's actually Petra. Petra is the place where the two witnesses are going to take the people and they're going to hide out there for a while. And while I can appreciate their enthusiasm for that, I don't really see a reason for that other than the fact that Petra is literally in the wilderness. But the fact of the matter is that wilderness here, I believe, can be thought of more of a spiritual metaphor, as in the wilderness of the world, the sinful place. And so it's an island in the midst of that spiritual desert or ocean, abyss, chaos, and that's going to be where those two witnesses are. That's going to be the peaceful zone. And my opinion, such as it's worth, is that that will be the Temple Mount area, possibly the Old City area. But I think for sure the Temple Mount area of Jerusalem. Anytime you want to engage me on some of these speculative things, feel free. My email address, always available to you, thomasjshort@comcast.net. Got about a minute and 20 seconds left, which is going to not leave us nearly enough time to get very far in the development of this next section. But it's verse 7 says, "Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back." Take that by itself first. Remember what I told you earlier from Ephesians chapter 6. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against these dark forces of the heavenly realms. It's against the fallen angels. And I believe Michael is fighting them in the spirit world on our behalf already. The dragon is clearly Satan, and so the dragon and his angels are clearly the bad guys in the spirit realm. And I believe Michael and his angels continue to fight on our behalf. And this has been going on a long time. We can see examples in the Old Testament, and I'll bring one of those up at the beginning of our next session. But this will go on until the kickoff of the day of the Lord.